Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Economics 101 when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our forefathers, he said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." Well, back in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. Now, in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. And they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills, and they gave us clad coinage in place of silver coins. So now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we are the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, that's another of the many lessons that we teach in our Mosaic Law School. We conduct that school here twice a year at the law school in spring and fall. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, doesn't cost anything. Why don't you call and order one right now? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, or better yet, click onto the archives page. Go to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package free of charge right there in the privacy of your home. All right, we've been talking about the fundamentals of economics, and I introduced you to a book here that's called Economics in One Lesson. And it's an Economics 101 course for dummies like me, written by Henry Hazlitt back in 1946. Now, you've probably been educated concerning the economics of the 1930s and 40s. A fellow by the name of John Maynard Keynes came up with a neat plan. It's the liberal philosophy of economics. It's called, "You're entitled to a free lunch and you owe it to yourself today to get it." The other side of the coin says there's no such thing as a free lunch. And if you think that you can get a free lunch, well, then get after it. But there's no free lunch, and there's no such thing as something for nothing. And so we're constantly bombarded with things like minimum wage and rent control and parity prices and saving the industry and full employment and jobs, 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 and protective tariffs and savings and inflationary pressure and industrial democracy and unsustainable trends. These are economic terms that we constantly hear, probably don't know much about, probably don't really understand them. If you do, you're a mile ahead of me, because I don't know what the hell these guys are talking about. And the truth of the matter is, I don't think that they know what they're talking about either. It's kind of like the old story of the emperor's new clothes. And you finally have to step back and look at this thing and say, you know, that sucker's naked. That's what that all boils down to. That guy's naked. Now, in looking at this week's privateer, on page one, there's a little story here called Dream Time. Let me read you a paragraph or two about Dream Time, because this is the era of dreamers. He says, "While patiently waiting for the House of Representatives to approve the Senate's bill ramping up the debt limit so that he can sign it into law, President Barack Obama announced his plans for the U.S. government's fiscal 2011 budget that begins October the 1st, 2010. Mr. Obama plans to spend $3.8 trillion in fiscal 2011, but he intends to be cautious about it. President Obama said this, he said, "We simply cannot continue to spend as if the deficits do not have consequences, as if the tax dollars of the American people can be treated like monopoly money," unquote. You know, that's hilarious. In the fiscal year 2000, the official increase in funded Treasury debt was just under $18 billion. 3 years later, by 2003, the first year of the Iraq War, President Bush's government was surpassing the record that was set by his father back in 1991. And over the fiscal years 2003 to 2007, the annual increase in Treasury-funded debt averaged $556 billion a year. In fiscal 2008, that was almost doubled to U.S. $1.017 trillion. That's $1,017 billion. In fiscal 2009, it was almost doubled again to $1,885 billion. That's $1.8 trillion. Now listen to this. It took 194 years between 1787 and 1981 for the Treasury debt limit to reach $1 trillion. Then it took 27 years until 2008 to boost that to $10 trillion. The coming debt limit rise is going to push nearly halfway to $20 trillion. Now that's a feat accomplished in not much more than 2 years. 2 years. Now this is what is known as an unsustainable trend. Now you've heard that term used a few times. President Bush came up with it before he left office, and he said, you know, the spending that we're engaged in the Social Security Administration, the way its budgets are balanced and so on, he says it's unsustainable. Unsustainable. You ever thought about what unsustainable means? What's this guy saying? Then Barack Obama comes along and he says, hey, this is unsustainable. Well, the first guy that came up with this unsustainable is a fellow by the name of Herbert Stein. And it's been codified by economists in later years after Stein came up with it. It's called Stein's Law. Herbert Stein. The law is named for Mr. Herbert Stein, the chairman of the Council on Economic Advisors in the first half of the 1970s under Presidents Nixon and Ford. The law is simplicity itself, and it's very useful when contemplating this term called unsustainable trends. And here's what it is. Quote, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. God, I'm going to underline that. This is genius, isn't it? If something cannot go on forever, it will stop. And that's where we're headed here. You know, we're talking about terms like minimum wage. Now, we're all familiar with that. And everybody's in favor of a minimum wage, aren't they? We need minimum wage, don't we? And what about rent control? Why, if we didn't have rent control, why, those landlords, you know, would gouge us and charge us, you know, rents that were just ridiculous and unfair. And then the farmers want parity prices. And then we need to save the industry. That's what we just did, you know, the banking industry. Oh, my God, we can't let that collapse. We had to save it, and we did. And then we got to have full employment. We don't have it, but that's what we're aiming for. And to get full employment, we have to have jobs, jobs, jobs. And now our government is installing protective tariffs to protect those jobs, jobs, jobs. And Americans' savings rates now have gone up by about 500%. We were saving about 1% back in the summer of 2008. Now we're saving about 5%, maybe a little over. And then there's inflationary pressure that they warn us about. We got to watch out for inflationary pressure. And then if it isn't inflationary pressure, then it's deflationary pressure. And then they're telling us that what's going on around us constitute unsustainable trends. Now, isn't that just real special? That comes from The Privateer, by the way. And you can get a copy of The Privateer and find out more about him. Let me give you his name and number. His name is William A.M. Buckler. And they're in Australia. And they're online. And you can go to theprivateer.com. That's easy enough. www.the-privateer.com. I think that's the easiest way to find them. Now, if you want to call them on the telephone, the number is 617-5471-1960. That's 617-5471-1960. That's The Privateer. It's not free. It costs you about $180 a year in Australian. Now, here's another statement that comes from, if you want to see what's going on around us in present time, in real time, and this comes from the international forecaster. This is Bob Chapman. Bob Chapman here, theinternationalforecaster.com. It's easy enough to find. And it's theinternationalforecaster.com. That's all one word. Here's what Bob had to say. Talking about the president's recent State of the Union message, he said, the inflationary depression still dominates and probably will continue to do so. In time, the stimulus will fail to work and the world will slip into total insolvency and deflationary depression. The old M3 is about 3%, but we still have $23.7 trillion floating around. And not only is the United States bankrupt, but also so is all the rest of the world. And it is now only a question of when the dominoes will fall. It looks like the first wave in the collapse of the bear market rally is now underway. Bonds will follow with higher interest rates, and eventually commodities will be hit. Only gold and silver will survive, and as the bankers and Wall Street complete their destruction of the world economy. Holding currency is also a loser. Eventually, the best will fall to gold and silver, and there is no possibility that quantitative easing can be curtailed, and that means debt will continue to grow and to grow exponentially. That means it's not going to grow 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's going to grow 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. Now, by way of example, in 2007, public debt as a percentage of gross domestic product was 62%, and this year it will be 94%, about a 30% increase. In England, the public debt as a percentage of GDP was 44%. Now it's 82%, about double. In the G20 countries, the percentage of GDP to public debt was 62%, and now it's 85%, and that's up 25%. In Europe, an average of 63% went up to 85%, except for Italy, at 104% to 120%, that's only up 16. And in Japan, 188%, it went up to 227. Now, Japan's a basket case. Listen to this now. By way of example, in 2007, public debt as a percentage of the gross domestic product in Japan was 188%, and it has now grown to 227%. Now, over the next 2 years, some of these nations are going to default. And you don't have to be concerned about Ireland, Greece, Portugal, Spain, and the Eastern Bloc countries of Europe, which are well on the way to being basket cases. Due to current economic conditions, these nations cannot generate revenue sufficient to even pay the service on the debt, much less reduce the debt itself. Revenues are off 11% in the United States, and they're headed even lower. In the president's budget, $100 billion is earmarked for incentives for job creation, and $25 billion for the states that are generally incapable of even paying unemployment compensation. 40 states in America are on the edge of bankruptcy, and the president wants to double the aid to education in a totally failed system. Governmental debt is growing at a rate of more than 20% per annum, and we can pencil in the bailout programs and the bankruptcy of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae, FHA, AIG, and General Motors. And the 19 major banks are all insolvent. These are the too big to fail banks. Every single one of them is insolvent. They're all keeping two sets of books, and they use the mark to model, not a mark to market, to determine their assets and liabilities. And that means their assets are worth what they say they're worth. And the collapse of the credit crisis is still underway. And all the king's horses and all the king's men cannot put America back together again. And that's because we're in the midst of an unsustainable trend. And if it cannot continue, then it will stop. Let me refer you to block number one again. Now, as we have often said, the turning point for the dollar and the American economy can be pinpointed to the date of August the 15th, 1971, when the United States abandoned the gold standard, and that was followed by deindustrialization, free trade, globalization, offshoring, and outsourcing, which ripped the industrial heart out of America, sending our companies and our jobs to foreign lands so that transnational conglomerates could be enriched and enriched tax-free. The result since 1972, due to inflation, is that two incomes per family are now needed to financially survive. A very sad commentary, and the direct result of the actions of government, Wall Street, and banking. They ended sound money, and they gave us corporatist socialism, which is known as fascism. The result is presently inflationary depression. The value of our homes have fallen 50%, and many of us are buried in debt. If that wasn't enough, Congress increased the short-term debt limit this week, adding an additional $45,000 to the debt of every American. And we're told by government and Wall Street there is very little inflation, when in fact inflation is double what the government says it is. 10 banks here in America control 70% of the deposits that are deposited here in the entire country, and all of these banks are broke. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has $93 billion. $93 billion. 2,055 banks are in serious trouble. If 1,000 of those 2,055 banks go under, the cost would exceed $500 billion. The banks have already paid the FDIC their premiums due over the next 3 years in advance. And the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation does have a $500 billion line of credit with the Treasury, and we wonder if government dares to use that line of credit. Of course, the banking cartel, the monopoly, the Federal Reserve, can always print more money, and they can inflate the debt away. Now, sources in Washington tell us the administration expects Congress to pass another $150 billion stimulus plan to augment the new budget. That should carry the economy through the election. It's not the $500 billion the White House had in mind, but it is what they will have to work with. And incidentally, half of what government spends today, half of what government is spending in our national budget, is borrowed money. Now, we've warned you before to exit municipal bonds because you're looking at massive unfunded liabilities. These entities have no ability to repay debt under the circumstances extant today. And Southern and Eastern Europe debt markets have sent currency, bond and stock markets reeling over the past month. And the dollar rally was anticipated by insiders like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup in their massive long dollar positions. China overdid their stimulus plan of a net $2.2 trillion in the short space of just 10 months. And now they have bubbles in their stock and real estate markets that will cause real domestic problems shortly. The yen carry trade is close to over, but how big is the dollar carry trade? Have these traders created too much liquidity? Well, we don't know here, but we would guess the dollar carry trade is not nearly as large as some believe that it is. Corporations are talking about higher profits due to the surging dollar. But we doubt that, and we ask, how much will U.S. exports be hurt? And as a result, how much worse will our balance of payments debt become? Now, it seems like professionals in the bond markets worldwide are mesmerized, and they're accepting dangerously low yields just to play the game. That can become a very dangerous game indeed. They think nothing bad could possibly happen when the debt bomb is so obvious. Junk is junk, no matter how you cut it. Even in the so-called better quality issues, the 5-year U.S. T-note is yielding 2.15%, and the 10s are 3.58% with inflation in the real world over 7%. Why would any informed, sane investor reach for such losers? Never mind the junk. We're in a dead zone, and shortly inflation is going to surge again. Oil will move higher, as will commodities, gold and silver, as well-placed as they are, and as well-poised to test their old recent highs. The world's financial problems are not going to go away anytime soon, and that's why you have to be in gold and silver-related assets. Remember, that's Bob Chapman and the International Forecaster. If you'd like a copy, go to theinternationalforecaster.com. Now, again, unsustainable trends. What we're involved in here worldwide now are borrowing schemes and economic financial programs that are unsustainable. That's what the bottom line is. They're unsustainable. Yesterday, I mentioned to you, if you want to keep your job, assuming that your company can stay in business, you want to go to production and forget about employment. Concentrate on production. Because production in economics is the holy grail of economics. You know, anybody can take a job, collect a paycheck, and lean on a shovel. It takes a special breed of person to go out and produce something that's useful and productive. If you can produce something that's useful and productive, you don't need to worry about employment. Employment will take care of it. You don't need to worry about a paycheck. You're going to get paid. Production is where it's at. Now, let's take a look at this thing called minimum wage, because constantly I hear talk of minimum wage. In fact, they just raised it last year. What does minimum wage mean and what does it do? What is it for the economy? I know everybody believes in minimum wage. I'm not here to argue it. I'm not here to tell you to do away with it, that nobody's going to do away with the minimum wage. But I think you should understand what it does to the economy. What is the overall impact on the economy? Is it sustainable? Let's think about it for a second. The last time they raised it here in Missouri, I think they raised it from $5.25 or 35 cents to $6.60. And I think that the federal minimum wage, or at least some place I heard it was $7 and something. Well, boys and girls, if setting the minimum wage at $7 an hour, using the argument that, well, people have to have a minimum wage just in order to make ends meet. Well, hell, why give them a minimum wage to make ends meet? Why don't we give everybody a minimum wage so that we can all get prosperous? So let's set the minimum wage at $14 an hour and make every employer in America pay $14. Wouldn't that be twice as good as $7? I guess if $14 is twice as good as $7, wouldn't $28 an hour be twice as good as $14 an hour? And I mean, after all, if government has the power to compel us to pay this minimum wage, isn't that what government ought to be doing? I mean, let's quit pussyfooting around here with this $7 an hour flipping burgers, and let's get up to $28 an hour, which is where the American automobile industry is getting paid. They just closed a plant out in San Jose, California, and the Toyota people are paying $28 an hour. I think $28 an hour for flipping burgers at Burger King is a pretty good wage. And after all, the people at Burger King that are flipping burgers have just as many needs and desires and wants as do the auto workers that are building cars in San Jose, don't they? So, what would happen if we did that? Now, we've already seen some of the harmful results of arbitrary government efforts to raise the price of favored commodities. The same sort of harmful results follow efforts to raise wages through minimum wage laws. This ought not to be surprising because a wage is, in fact, a price. And it is unfortunate for clarity of economic thinking that the price of labor services should have received an entirely different name from other prices. This has prevented most people from recognizing that the same principles govern both prices and wages. Thinking has become so emotional and so politically biased on the subject of wages that in most discussions of wages, the plainest principles are totally ignored. People who would be among the first to deny that prosperity could be brought about by artificially boosting prices, people who would be among the first to point out that minimum price laws might be most harmful to the very industries that they're designed to help, will nevertheless advocate minimum wage laws and denounce any opponents of them without any misgivings whatsoever. And yet it ought to be clear that a minimum wage law is at best a limited weapon for combating the evil of low wages, and that the possible good to be achieved by such a minimum wage law can exceed the possible harm only in proportion as its aims are modest. The more ambitious such a law is, the larger the number of workers that it attempts to cover, and the more that it attempts to raise their wages, the more certain are its harmful effects to exceed any possible good effects. Now, the first thing that happens, for example, when a law is passed that no one shall be paid less than, let's say, $106 for a 40-hour week, is that no one who is not worth $106 a week to an employer will be employed at all. You cannot make a man worth a given amount of money by making it illegal for anyone to offer him anything less. You merely deprive him of the right to earn the amount that his abilities and his situation would permit him to earn. And while you deprive the community even of the moderate services that he's capable of rendering, in brief, for a low wage, you substitute unemployment. You do harm all around with no comparable compensation. And that's what happens to all the teenagers who want to go out and work. Now, just because you're a teenager and you want to work does not make you worth $7 an hour. And there's probably lots of work out there for you at $4 an hour or $2 an hour or $5 an hour, but it's not available at $7. So when the government says you have to pay this guy $7 an hour, it's the minimum wage. That just guarantees that everybody who can't produce or isn't worth $7 an hour will be unemployed. That's the poorest people in the community, which is all right because they can probably all go on welfare. So as soon as they go on welfare, they'll get $80 a week. And then the question arises, do I want to work for $106 or do I want to stay on welfare for $80? So we're really only talking about $26. Do I want to work for $26 a week? Because I can get $80 for nothing, and I have to work 40 hours to get $106. See where we're going? Keeping in mind now that this book was written in 1946. So if you want to bring it up to the present, you just take $7 an hour times 40 hours, $280. You have to pay $280 a week, and if this guy isn't worth $280 a week, delivering newspapers or whatever he's doing, then he ends up being unemployed, doesn't he? Now, there isn't any unemployment out there, but we can sure create it. And that's what we're doing. Minimum wage creates minimum unemployment. Hang on, I got to give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, or go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page and download it. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advisors, advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about unsustainable trends. Unsustainable. There are things that occur in life that are unsustainable. Let me give you an illustration. You're making $1,000 a month, and you're spending $1,100 a month. That's an unsustainable trend. How long can you do that? We don't know how much you're starting off with in the way of assets. You might last a year. You might last 5 years. Here in the United States, we've been on this spending binge since 1933. We got off on a spending binge in 1914 when we created the Federal Reserve System and started creating paper money. We went through World War I. We went through an inflationary boom in the 1920s. It collapsed in 1929. It was an unsustainable trend that ended. We went through a depression for about 10 years. And then when we came out of that depression, we continued on with an unsustainable trend after World War II. Now, you could say, but we have been spending and stimulating our economy, and we've been using this Keynes theory of economics for some 90 years, and you're right. This is the longest period in the history of the world that a fiat currency has survived. No fiat currency has ever lasted for 94 years before. We, here in America, have set a new record. God love us. New record. But it's unsustainable. It was unsustainable in 1933. It was unsustainable in 1945. It was unsustainable in 1970. It was unsustainable in 1985. It was unsustainable in 1999. It's unsustainable in 2010. It is unsustainable and will be unsustainable in 2020. I don't know how much longer these boys can keep these balls floating in the air. But it's unsustainable. They know it. You know it. I know it. Everybody knows it. It's just that all of us are in denial. We don't want to admit it because we really don't know what we're going to do about it. We don't know what to do to stop it, start it, control it, fix it, or die with it. We haven't got a clue. We're just kind of riding along in a torrent of water, wondering what's going to happen next. Well, getting back here to minimum wage, the only exception to this occurs when a group of workers is receiving a wage actually below its market value. This is likely to happen only in rare and special circumstances or localities where competitive forces do not operate freely or adequately, but nearly all of these special cases could be remedied just as effectively, more flexibly, and with far less potential harm by unionization. Now, it may be thought that if the law forces the payment of a higher wage in a given industry, that industry can then charge higher prices for its product, so that the burden of paying the higher wage is merely shifted to the consumer. These shifts, however, are not easily made, nor are the consequences of artificial wage raising so easily escaped. The higher price for the product may not be possible. It may merely drive consumers to the equivalent imported products or to some substitute. Back during World War II, they rationed butter. Well, all that did was open the floodgates for margarine. And so now margarine took the place of the butter. Now, the purpose for price controls and price subsidies was to protect the producers of butter. And I'm sure the government had the most magnanimous of purposes in mind. We just want to help the farmer with these price controls and these subsidies. And now the net result was they destroyed the butter industry and destroyed the dairy farmers, and they built a new industry called margarine. That was the net effect of it. Or if consumers continue to buy the product of the industry in which wages have been raised, the higher price will cause them to buy less of it. While some workers in the industry may be benefited from the higher wage, therefore others will be thrown out of employment altogether. On the other hand, if the price of the product is not raised, marginal producers in the industry will be driven out of business, so that reduced production and consequent unemployment will merely be brought about in some other way. Let me give you an illustration. There was a company called Stanley. Stanley Tools. I mean, they're an old company, been here in the United States for, 100, 200 years. And they're located up in the Northeast somewhere, I think around Boston, Massachusetts. Well, back in the 1980s, when we got into this free trade trip with the Chinese, I went over to the True Value Hardware store one day, and the price of a 25-foot Stanley contractor's tape measure was $12, which had been the price for 25-foot contractors, you know, that's those one-inch wide tapes, had been for quite some time, $12. And we thought, well, $12 is a reasonable price. It's worth $12. But the Chinese brought them in here, and they were selling them for $3, one-fourth the price that the Stanley people were getting. Well, now, you know, you and I are just a couple of Joe Sixpacks. Now, here's a tape measure made in the United States for $12, and here's a tape measure made in China for $3, and you pick it up, and you pull it out, and you test it, and you look at it, and say, hey, this thing looks like it's just as good as that Stanley. So you buy it. You take it out on the job, and sure enough, it's just as good as that Stanley. All right, so the Chinese don't pay any minimum wage. They pay slave labor. And I'm not contending that they have slaves over there, but they pay the equivalent of what we would call slave labor here in the United States. They're probably paying those workers over there to turn out those tapes, you know, $1 an hour maybe, $2 a day, $5 a day. I don't know what they're paying, but it's not much. Here in the United States, back in the 80s, the minimum wage was $3 to $4 an hour, and you got to pay this minimum wage. So the Stanley Company is forced to pay this minimum wage by law here in the United States to produce tapes, and they got to charge $12. The Chinese don't have to pay any minimum wage. They can bring all the tapes into the country that they want to, and they can sell those tapes for a fourth of what the Stanley people can do. Now, let me just ask you this. Let's suppose that you're the Stanley Company, and you're producing these tapes in Massachusetts. Would you go to your legislature and say, hey, listen, we need protective tariffs? Why don't you charge a $9 tariff on every one of those and make those Chinese sell their tapes at $12, just like we sell our tapes at $12? And then the federal government can take the $9 tariff price and apply that in place of the income tax. Did you know we Americans used to finance our federal government with these imposts and exposts? Yeah, we didn't have an income tax. We used to make the foreigners that wanted to sell their goods in this country, we made them pay the tax. Then some guy woke up, some economist woke up and said, that ain't fair to the foreigners. Let's practice free trade, take off all the tariffs and make the Americans pay income tax and pay the tax to support the government and let the foreigners have a free ride. Well, listen, I'm not here to argue about the policy. I'm just here to report to you that evidently you thought that was a good idea. So I asked you, well, what would you do if you were the Stanley Company? Well, here's what Stanley did. They moved their operations to China so that they could hire the same slave labor to make their Stanley tapes, so that they could sell their Stanley tapes here in the States for $3 a tape, just like the Chinese company sell theirs over here for $3 a tape. Now, for those of us that are consuming the tapes, it's no big deal. But for the employees of the Stanley Company, these government policies, these minimum wage policies, cause unemployment. It causes the companies to move their operations overseas. So you're mad as hell with these companies because they're outsourcing their jobs. But you don't get mad as hell at the government that forces these taxes and forces these prices on these companies, now do you? Now, the other day we were talking about Detroit and how Detroit is disintegrating right in front of our eyeballs. Well, boys and girls, there's a cause and effect relationship here. When General Motors was paying top dollar and top wages back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, they had the dominant share of the pie. Our government decided to let the Japanese and anybody else that wanted to sell cars in this country to sell their cars over here. Now, the Japanese could build their cars over in Tokyo for $15 an hour while our guys over here were getting paid $30. And so the General Motors people couldn't compete with that. And so the inevitable outcome is what you're witnessing today, the bankruptcy of our American automobile industry. You shouldn't be surprised. Now, we've got minimum wage laws, and we require General Motors and all these companies now to pay these wages by law, but we don't require that of the Japanese or of the Chinese or anybody else. Now, you want to have free trade. I don't know why, but you do. I'm not here to argue with your free trade policy, but you should understand that there's a cause and effect relationship here, and that if you're going to let somebody come in here and sell to you, and then you're going to let them produce their product for $15 an hour wages, and you're going to make your companies, your countrymen, pay $30 an hour wages, do you think that your company, your country, can survive that? Do you believe that? You know, that's what the privateer is talking about here. When they use this headline, they say, this is dream time. The American public has been daydreaming for the last 50 or 75 years. You keep listening to these politicians, and you keep listening to these economists, and they're telling you stories. And God, these stories sound real good. I don't deny it. Minimum wage sounds wonderful. I don't have any quarrel with how minimum wage sounds. It's just that when you actually put minimum wage into operation, there's a cause and effect result that comes from it. So when you put compulsory union membership into the equation, well, then what happens is you get a cause and effect relationship that comes from it. That's what the bottom line is. Now, what we have done to ourselves here in America is unsustainable. I remember some years back, the politicians got together and said, hey, you got a bunch of people getting hurt and killed in American industry. We need an Occupational Health and Safety Administration. So Congress got busy and enacted this law. Here in the United States, we require companies to put safety measures into operation. And God, I'm not opposed to safety measures. I think that's a great idea. But they don't do that in China, and they don't do that in Japan. So you Americans are insisting that American employers perform to standards that are expensive standards to perform to, that American business has to compete against companies that don't have to perform to those standards. The Japanese don't have to meet those standards. They don't have to pay out those expenses. And so therefore, they can sell their products cheaper over here. And you know, you're no dummy, so you're sitting here saying, well, why should I pay more money for a Chevrolet when I can buy this Toyota or this Honda? And that makes all the sense in the world. Until you start adding up these cause and effect relationships, and these policies become unsustainable. Now, we sustained it for 50 years, but we're at the point today where it now, not only is it unsustainable, but now the economy is unraveling right in front of your eyeballs. Detroit, Philadelphia, and the big cities, they are deteriorating. They're just melting right in front of your eyeballs. There was a time in America when we followed the free market enterprise system that built Philadelphia, that built New York, that built Detroit. Then we adopted policies, probably well-meaning, like OSHA and the EPA and the State Tax Commission. We had the best of intentions. I'm not denying that. We wanted to provide minimum wage so that people could have a living wage. That's very magnanimous. It's very altruistic. But when you carry that into its final analysis, it's unsustainable. There's a result that comes from it. Now, when such consequences are pointed out, there are those who reply, well, very well, if it is true that the X industry cannot exist except by paying starvation wages, then it will be just as well if the minimum wage puts it out of existence altogether. But this brave pronouncement overlooks the realities. It overlooks, first of all, that consumers will suffer the loss of that product, and it forgets, in the second place, that it is merely condemning the people who worked in that industry to unemployment. And it ignores, finally, that bad as were the wages paid in the X industry, they were the best among all the alternatives that seemed open to the workers in that industry at that time. Otherwise, the workers would have gone into some other industry. If, therefore, the X industry is driven out of existence by a minimum wage law, then the workers previously employed in that industry will be forced to turn to alternative courses that seemed less attractive to them in the first place. Their competition for jobs will drive down the pay offered even at those alternative occupations. There is no escape from the conclusion that the minimum wage will increase unemployment. Well, let's test that one out for a minute and we'll show how this works. Down in Argentina, they had an economic collapse, and the unemployment rate finally hit 63% at its peak. 63%. So when we drive somebody out of his occupation, when we raise the minimum wage and we can't pay this guy that minimum wage and he goes out on the street unemployed, he's one more guy looking for your job. And so what happens here is you have 100 jobs and 100 people working. We come along and we say, okay, everybody's got to pay $7 an hour. Okay, five people get knocked out of a job. 95 people are working, but five guys are out of a job. So five guys are now willing to work for something less than you are. And nobody gets paid just exactly $7 an hour, which is the minimum wage. Some people get 7, 10, 15, 20, or 25. So what happens is the guy that was knocked out of employment at $7 an hour is out knocking on doors and is willing to work and take your job. And you're making 15 bucks an hour, and I'm unemployed. So I say, hell, I'm willing to work for $12 an hour. And so the employer says, well, why would I want to hire this guy for 15 when old George will come in here and do it for 12? Hell, I was willing to work for 5 bucks an hour until the government came along and said, no, you got to work for 7 minimum. And so now I'm out here pounding the pavement looking for a job. And hell, I'll take a job for more than $7 an hour. The more people that are out there beating the pavement looking for a job, and that's what happened in Argentina, wages were driven down. And the higher unemployment goes, when here in America today it's about 20% unemployment. Fortunately, in America, we still have the dole. So the people, when they can't get a job that pays them $20 an hour, they say, well, then the dole will pay me $15 an hour or $10 an hour or unemployment insurance. While it doesn't pay 20, it pays 80% of that or 70% of that. Boys and girls, when the government goes bankrupt, there won't be any dole. there won't be any unemployment insurance. Then you're going to have the full force of all those unemployed people knocking on every employer's door saying, look, if this guy's working for 15, I'll work for 12. The next week, a guy comes by and says, you're paying this guy 12, I'll do it for 10. The next week, you're paying this guy $10, I'll do it for 8. The next week, you're paying this guy 8 bucks, I'll do it for 6. It's a race to the bottom. And when we're talking about the dole, remember, you can either pay this guy unemployment insurance or you can pay him his wages. Would you rather the guy be working for wages and producing something? Or would you rather he be sitting at home playing on his computer, watching television, and collecting 80%? Because that takes the initiative out. It takes the incentive to work out of a person. If I can collect 80% of a week's pay doing nothing, why would I want to work? Then these people start working under the table. Now they're working for cash. This is called the underground economy. And this is where all these Mexicans are. Hell, they're coming up here from South America, and they're working for cash. And every one of those guys is undermining the workforce. Now, this is the system that we've set up. It was set up back in the 1930s. We have this Davis-Bacon thing I told you about yesterday. The government requires on a government project that you pay these Davis-Bacon wages. Well, okay. That just drives up the cost of doing the project until, in most cases, in most of the inner cities, it is not worth fixing those houses. But if we didn't have to pay those artificially high wages, there are a lot of people out there that would be glad to fix those houses and be glad to work for the wages that the marketplace would support. The marketplace is the best arbiter for determining what prices should be, whether it's wages, whether it's rents, or whether it's prices. And you just leave it alone, and the marketplace itself will make that determination. The people who are actually doing the buying, the selling, and the trading will come to an agreement, just one transaction at a time. And then over time, you can put all these transactions together and come up with an average. But you can't beat the free marketplace, because over 4,000 years of history, it's never failed. And socialism has never succeeded. So there's the stark contrast. Hey, I'm out of time. I've got to give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.